This week on the show, Netflix goes big and then blows up. Google TV gets sandbagged by the big three. Boxy tries to break out. And for Sony, it's the end of an era. Right here on This Week in Media, number 207. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and I will be your pilot for today as we move through the clouds of media. And joined on this little plane of ours, we've got Steve Garfield. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. You have the Steve Garfield TV.
Yep. SteveGarfield.tv is a new thing I'm doing. It's a weekly live show on the Pulse Network, Thursdays at 2. It's all about online video and social media.
Fantastic. Also on the call, Tim Street, of course. Tim, hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's going great.
Are you in LA? Are you in LA in the right now?
I am in LA. Last week was Digital Hollywood. This week's going to be OMA. So I'm convention boy for M Dialogue.
You're kind of there's a convention every week. It seems like there's a pertinent convention every week.
Well, you know, right now with what's going on in the iPad world and the tablet world, it seems like everybody and their brother is trying to get on that bandwagon.
Right.
So, yeah, for sure.
Right, definitely. And Lon,
Simon. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well.
How's the local online news?
It's going very well. We've been doing some consulting work and have a couple of commercial projects in the works also, so we're having a good month.
Hey, before we get started, I want to know what your thoughts are related to FaceTime and its interaction now with the computer. Do you see that affecting local online news at all?
I think it gives us more flexibility for getting things coming back in from the field. We've been using Ustream on occasion, using an iPhone. One of our partners that covers state political events has been doing a lot of streaming off of an iPhone 4 to Ustream. So it gives us another avenue. The big barrier is the fact that we can't use the FaceTime with a 3G signal, that it has to be a Wi-Fi. So if we don't have a Wi-Fi out there with somebody, then it's a little less useful, but it's great, though. The quality's good. I think it does add a real sense of flexibility to some of the things that we would normally do. So I'm excited about it, and the video quality's great. So
I'm just very curious. I was very excited about that. I do agree with the limitations related to not being able to use it over 3G, but the MiFi works pretty well. I think that it depends on where you are in the United States. Some places MiFi is screaming, and some places it's not much better than dial-up. So
it's always hit or miss. It really is.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so just curious what you thought of that. Our first story here is Netflix soars, investors cheer, and then the web service crashes. This is according to Reuters. It has been, what they're talking about is the growth of Netflix, of course, and the fact that it has just been, one of the things that they were talking about is that 3 years ago we were a DVD by mail company that offered some streaming. Now we are a streaming company that, offers a little bit of DVD. Now it crashed. I don't know if that's really I don't know if that's really the news. The news is really that now Netflix accounts for an estimated 20% of peak U.S. internet bandwidth traffic between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m., according to the study by Sandvine. So Tim, do you think that this is, I think that number, that 20% of the bandwidth, do you think this poses a threat to kind of a looming conflict with cable providers?
Yeah, absolutely. Netflix is must-see TV now. I mean, that's what people are watching. I mean, it's the promised land, We were told that cable TV would allow us to watch what we wanted to watch, when we wanted to watch it, and for some reason, that just didn't work out right. It's not easy to navigate VOD in the cable world, and Netflix is searchable. It's easy to use. You've got it hooked up to your laptop, or you're watching it on your iPad, and it's great. Cable can't compete with that right now. They need to do something, and Comcast is working hard on it. I mean, they're trying to get their iPad app out there and make this happen, but it's a huge threat to cable television. And I've noticed that when I'm using Netflix for an extended period of time, my cable provider, who I get my internet connection from, seems to slow down.
You know, I've noticed that as well. I've actually noticed that I when I'm using it a lot, day after day after day, suddenly it starts to become a little more choppy. Now, Steve, do you think that cable providers do you think it terrifies them that they may just become a dumb pipe?
Well, the thing is, with all the data and people getting things for free over the internet, they want some of that money.
Right.
You know, how can they let all this streaming take up, so now it says 20% of their, it's only 2% of you and getting any money other than, well, I mean, I'm kind of on unlimited monthly, you know, they're going to probably take a step back and say, now, wait a minute, we need to get, you know, compensated. It's like for the open internet too. It's like with different bandwidths and charge money, and they're just going to need to charge for people using all their bandwidth. Don't you guys think?
Well, right now, I guess we're paying. You know, we don't have unlimited bandwidth. I have Comcast here in my office.
Yeah.
So we're already, you know, capped at 250 gigs, which doesn't seem like. It seems like that's plenty until you start watching Netflix every night, 3 hours a night. Then it starts to become something that is a little bit more, you know, constraining.
Although, before you go on, I mean, I would disagree with Tim because I have Netflix and I still get the DVDs. And the reason I love getting the DVDs from Netflix is because of all the behind-the-scenes features and like the making of and all those things, and you don't get those online with Netflix. So I do still see the value of getting the DVDs at home.
I buy DVDs if I want the behind the scenes, mostly because I use them for work. You know, I mean, I use them. I mean, as far as I actually study them. If I want a DVD, I'll buy it if it has the behind the scenes. But I think a lot of times a lot of these companies have devalued, these behind the scenes. You see less and less of these super special. DVD releases. And for me, if I go up there and I see that there's not going to be any really deep behind the scenes specials, as far as I'm concerned, I can just stream it because they're not really offering me anything that I want extra.
True.
Lon, do you think that plastic is even relevant anymore? I mean, do you think that people are really, is there a long term, future for Blu-ray for DVDs?
I think there might be in a more of a niche kind of way. I'm a home theater nerd. I have like a really decent sound system and plasma television, and I really like the quality that I had of Blu-ray. And I had a player back in the day. I don't know if you had one of those, but I think there's still a tremendous value for the enthusiasts out there who really want to get the whole movie experience that directors intended for them to have. But there are times when I watching television. Shows or whatever that I'm perfectly fine with the streaming as well. So I see as Blu-ray kind of get relegated out to that niche market, the movies will probably go back up in price. Let's not forget that Laserdiscs were in the $40 to $50 range back in the mid-90s when they really were the most popular. So I think there's going to be probably some balance there, but certainly going more to streaming just because it's easier and more on demand than waiting for the mail to show up.
Yeah, I know. I was listening to Leo talk about I don't know which show was on Twit, and he was talking about they were talking about when was the oldest disc that they hadn't returned to Netflix, and I realized that I went back and looked, and it was April 9th, 2009. In fact, that's the last time I got one. I mean, I have three discs. I have three discs sitting around the office somewhere that I haven't returned, and it doesn't matter because that was the April of 2009 was when I stopped, dealing with plastic. I think that's been the I realized that was the date. That was the day. it was
the day of reckoning.
Yeah, that was it. Now, do we think that with Netflix exploding, with Netflix doing so well, is there really a future, Tim? Is there really a future for a la carte purchasing? I mean, is that really viable when it looks like people are going to be just getting pretty much everything they want for some kind of monthly subscription?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It does look like that. I think people are going to try it. There's always some people that want to buy things rather than subscribe to them. And, there may be a market for that. But I think for the most part, we're going to see subscription services that are just all you can eat.
I think there's a place for a la carte pricing, and that's especially when it's Oscar time, and like I haven't seen all the movies yet in the theaters, and I want to see them all real quick, and we have a theater nearby where they have this day-long thing, and you buy a ticket, and you just go watch all the movies one after another. I would love to be able to be at home and maybe pay a premium for movies that even might be still in the theater or just left the theater, and I'd pay extra maybe any time to see first-run movies at home.
Now, do you find that the fact that we have that we have so much access to content, the fact that a lot of us have big TVs at home, is that really affecting how we approach going to the theater? I know for me, a lot of times I'm looking at it as when I look at going to the theater now. If I look at a kind of an artsy film or a kind of romantic film or something like that, I go,
nice word.
Well, no. I mean, I just like when I look at one that doesn't feel like it's going to be a big event. It doesn't look like it's going to be something that needs to be seen on the giant screen. I find myself more and more just going, now I have something to watch when it comes out. And I don't really care whether it comes out in 30 days or 60 days or 90 days or sometime late 2011. It's just going to be another thing because I actually want things to be there when I want to watch something in the evening. I don't want it to be, I don't want to have watched everything in the theater. I just noticed this kind of methodology happening in my thought process in the not, recently. And I'm just kind of curious, do you guys find that to be the case for you? Are you going more just to the big films and not so much to the little ones?
Yes,
I go to the big ones.
I think. Exactly like you. Yep.
For me, definitely, it's the big films that I go out and see. My wife is a big Harry Potter fan, so I will undoubtedly be dragged out for that one. And I dragged her out to Star Trek last year. But those two films in the last 2 years were the only two that I saw in the theater. And maybe I'm a bit of an anomaly, but if I get there too late, you get a really bad seat. You get a stiff neck walking out of there because you're staring up at the screen the whole time. So the movie theater experience for me just is not enjoyable. And I have a nice setup at home, which is so much nicer than being there.
My wife makes fun of me because I consider late being there about 15 minutes before the film starts, 15 to 20 minutes before the film starts, because there's only about 30 seats in the theater that I'm willing to sit in.
And right, so, I'm the same way.
So and literally, if I can't get to those 30 seats, I literally walk out and get a refund or get them to give me a rain check for another seat. I mean, I just go, I'm not going to spend $10 on this or $20 if I'm taking my wife or $30 or whatever it is now. And so but I always get there early. And for me, the solution is really Angry Birds. There's 15 more minutes of me figuring out how to push all of my stuff to 3 stars. So also in the news, Boxy Box is available on November 17th. This is according at CES. Of course, we heard about the D-Link introducing the Boxy Box. This is from Digital Home. They said they'll be shipping November 10th, and they should be in stores November 17th. Now here's the question. Tim, is there a place for Boxy in this increasingly crowded market for streaming boxes? How many boxes can we handle?
Two. You can handle two boxes, no more. No, I don't know. You know, for me, Boxy has passed me by. I mean, there was a time where I was really interested in Boxy. I like the Boxy guys. I see them at conventions all the time, and I thought Boxy was a great service, but now I have Roku and I have Apple TV and I've got Netflix working on my Wii. I don't need another box, do I?
Well, then, Lon, what do you see? What makes Boxy different? Why would someone pick that over the Roku, over Apple TV?
I don't know what people would pick over it because it's so much more expensive than those other two. I use Boxy on my Mac Mini that's hooked up to a TV in my bedroom, and I do like the curation side of it, that they do a very good job of finding all of this stuff all over the web, including old programs, like old TV shows. I think I was watching the original V a couple months ago on there just because I found it through their interface. So the user interface is probably among the best of the boxes out there, at least on the computer side of it. I don't know how the D-Link manufactured device will be. But the pricing on this thing, it looks like the market is really $100 or less. Right. And from the cable company, it's free. And people will pay a little bit more for a game console, but that does more. So I think they may have priced themselves out of the market on this one because the product is good. I mean, it handles Hulu even and other things. It's not always perfect, but I do think that's what sets it apart, and I just hope they can find a way to reduce price.
Steve, do you think that this market is getting too crowded for more? Has that like making lots of different railroads kind of ended as far as this process goes? Are we getting down to a handful of providers that are going to be really competing with each other from now on?
Well, I think so, because it's too confusing for people to choose which box to get. Like, I think that the cable companies are going to have to make it very easy for you not to choose a box other than their own box. So I have Comcast, and they put TiVo on it, which isn't really that great. So I have, you know, I have the TiVo box. That's my where I get all my content from. And for me personally, I mean, I have so many shows stacked up on TiVo that are, you know, cable TV shows. I don't have much time for going on the internet to watch shows. So where I usually watch them is on this really nice big Asus monitor I just got. It's like an HD monitor. It's beautiful. It's hooked up to my MacBook Pro. So I'm not thinking I need an extra box hooked up to my TV. I like the idea of what Google TV is, where I can sit back and watch down in my den and watch internet shows. But I'm just going to probably look for what's like the cheapest little internet thing to hook my TV up to, if it comes to that. But right now, I'm not at that point.
Well, one thing that I have started to, you know, this theory that I'm starting to postulate related to this, and I think I might have talked about it on Twin before, but the idea that, you know, one of the problems that really I think has afflicted the music industry, that I think is coming to the visual, you know, the content industry in general, is the fact that we have access to so much content. Before, if you didn't see a show or you didn't record it on VHS tape, you know, you didn't have it. So there was a kind of a, you didn't have this big stockpile of video that you could always go back to fill your time when you wanted to just, you know, turn your mind off. Nowadays, you know, we just have heaps and heaps and heaps of content that are at our fingertips, that are either on our iPad or on our Roku or on our Apple TV. And does this decrease the pressure for us to watch new content? Is this something that, you know, it more than piracy, more than anything else, is going to start affecting these companies where people are just saturated with content? What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. It's death by a thousand cuts. Mm-hmm. It's tougher than ever to launch a new show. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's still middle America where, you know, people don't have all these boxes, and that's who, you know, people who are launching programs need to pay attention to right now. But even that will go away. And so I think we're going to see some new ways of doing this. I also think we're going to see TV shows reinvented, and they'll be more interactive, and they'll be inside apps. And so there'll be a change of the way we consume programming, and it'll be interesting to see how many people try to put the horse back in the barn or the genie back in the bottle in terms of getting people to pay for content.
And speaking of that, oh, go ahead, Lon.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add is just that for content creators like us, there's for every box, there's a different process in which you get your content onto it. Some of them are more difficult than others. And the need to standardize how we as content creators can get ourselves out to all of these things really needs to happen, because it's really confusing right now, especially for smaller operations. As Tim said, it's hard to launch a show, not only because there's so much content out there, but it's so difficult to make sure that you're being covered by all these devices out there.
Right, absolutely. And I think that also puts a lot of pressure on the fact that you won't pay attention to the smaller devices, because they're just simply another – it's not just that it, you know, you're just going to throw the video over there, that there's a whole pipeline that you have to build just to support another box. And then you have to make a decision about what kind of market share does it have, and is it really worth my time, you know, or effort or resources to go down that path. Speaking of other ways of getting media out, this is according to PR Newswire. Paramount Digital Entertainment is teaming up with Ben Stiller's Red Hour Films for an exclusive first look to digital media deals. So essentially what Red Hour Films is doing is, you know, looking at a variety of formats, live action, animated webisodes, social media games in both digital and mobile platforms, mixed with TV. So the idea is that they're developing stuff for the TV, but they're also looking at ways to support that, build around it, build all kinds of other content on many, many different platforms, rather than just building a big one and having it purely as support for that, but really looking at that as an entire media, you know, push forward. Tim, do you think this is? Do you see this as the future of media development? Is to really think about this at the beginning and really start building the content into every avenue, rather than just TV for the big people, the big people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at what Electric Farm has done in terms of developing TV shows and putting them out on the web to begin with, you know, in the past, movie studios and TV networks have spent all this money developing shows that some never make it to air. There's a pilot shot, that pilot never makes it to air. And then sometimes the pilot gets on TV and then it gets canceled. This, with approaching things digitally and putting them out there on the internet, finding out if there is an audience, building an audience that cares about it, you can monetize your pilot. You can get money, dollars, revenue up front for it being on the internet. And then if it does have an audience, take it to TV. So I see that as a new model. It just happened with a show that was independently produced, I think, in Canada, and wound up on Sci-Fi. So I think we're going to see more and more of that.
I know. For me, we have a couple different shows that we're actually looking at building the basically the sequel, like the TV show or movie that someday we'd want to do is actually will be the prequel to what we're going to put on the web. And so, you know, and the web will come out in lots of small increments. But, you know, we're definitely focused on that. Do you think that this is Steve, do you think this is an insider-only kind of game, or do you think that this really provides a lot of opportunities for those on the outside to find a way to dig their way onto the inside?
Well, I think it's, for creative people, that it's wide open for people to develop, especially with interactivity on the website. S-Curve Records just came out with this Andy Grammer interactive video, and that's something that I, you know, I'm very interested in how you can make web video interactive. And I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's this Andy Grammer video, and Vivo and S-Curve Records, they all teamed up together. And so it's a regular music video when he's walking down the street singing, and then all of a sudden this overlay comes up, and for example, it says, what do you want him to do next? Bump into the movers or get dumped by bikers. But the video doesn't stop, and you have a certain amount of time to click on what you want, and then it seamlessly goes into the next scene that you just chose, and there's about 5 or 7 different choice points during the video. So there are hundreds of ways that the music video can go. So I found that very interesting. The technology is really, really cool. And so I think there's a lot of companies that are looking at ways to use the web and be interactive with videos in a really kind of cool, unique way.
Yeah, I think that I noticed that. I mean, this is one of the things that's in the next story, but I definitely find myself dual screening a lot. You know, and I've been doing that for 10 years where I have my laptop open while I'm watching TV, and I'm kind of half in, half out of watching the shows. But I find myself more and more watching things like I'll be watching Frontline on PBS, and then I'll be also searching, you know, Googling information about the show that I'm watching while I'm watching it. You know, and kind of deepening, you know, that process. And I think that, you know, it's interesting for fictional content. I think it's in some ways more interesting for non-fictional and how-to content. I think that dual screen could turn into something that is a real opportunity. Lon, do you see this affecting, for instance, things like local news?
Absolutely. And I think one of the exciting things about where we're at in this business, in this industry, is that the business model hasn't really been worked out yet. And if you look at the development of television, newspapers, radio, that a lot of those business models were determined, in some cases, over a century ago or half a century ago. And we're at that early stage now where the things that we're trying to do as creators and people listening doing as creators may largely determine the path of this industry. And that's what makes it such an exciting time to be involved with this, because there's a lot of opportunity for someone to figure this out and really do quite well.
Well, yeah. And isn't that always the time for the outsider, is when chaos is occurring? It's not good for the insider, but it's usually good for the outsider, because those things are not, you know, set in stone, and there's lots of cracks to move through.
Absolutely, and that's, you know, that's part of what we're doing on a smaller level here, just trying to experiment to see exactly what the business model is going to be, what do people want to consume, and it's largely democratic, because if they're not interested in it, they don't watch it, and we see the number, and we adjust, and I think that's what this Red Hour film project is about as well, seeing what sticks, and I could see a number of shows that didn't make it on television that had huge fan bases. Jericho, which was on CBS, is a great example, could probably thrive in this kind of business model that wasn't determined upon television ratings. So it's exciting, and I'm really looking forward to reading more about it.
Also in the news, networks are blocking some web video from Google TV. This is so three major networks are reportedly blocking, this is according to PC Mag, reportedly blocking the web-based versions of popular TV shows when accessed by Google's Google TV platform, according to a report. So these are shows like NBC's The Office, CBS's CSI, Crime and Scene Investigation, and ABC's Modern Family cannot be viewed via the Google TV network. And that also includes the Logitech Review and Sony's Blu-ray player and a number of other internet-connected TVs. So, you know, it looks like this is the beginning of this little battle where Google has, you know, effectively, and I think to the, we were talking about this a little bit with Netflix, is they're working around the industry, and the industry is now starting to tighten those clamps down. Steve, do you think that working around these content companies is workable in the long run? Does Google have to find a way to play with them?
I think that an update to that story that I read just within the past day was that Google's talking to them now about, you know, about paying them.
How can we all be friends?
Yeah. So I think they're going to have to work it out, because if Google wants to, it's like, you know, turning on the TV and not getting your main network stations. That's, you know, Google TV is TV. So I think they're going to have to work it out.
If this doesn't get sorted out quickly, if they don't find a resolution, do you think this is the beginning of the end of Google TV? If all of this starts to get clamped down, does it make it too complicated?
No, I think it forces another issue. So if my TV is a flat screen TV and I hook up a Mac Mini to it, are they going to block that? You know, I mean, that's what Lon's doing. And Lon, can you watch those shows on your Mac Mini?
I can watch whatever I can get on the web on my Mac Mini, so yeah. I can certainly get around it.
Yeah, so this seems like a weird technicality to me, just because it's a TV, whereas Lon watches his stuff on a TV through a Mac Mini. So is it the big question is it the beginning of the end of the web? Are we going to see anything that's worth watching put inside a paywall?
Well, yeah, and I think that the question there is that, I mean, I think that the larger question is really, is this the beginning? As we start to see these appliances start to move forward, is this the beginning of the end of watching content on the web in general? When you look at whether it's Netflix or whether it's Apple TV, you know, what we're looking at is a very net app-driven world, and a lot less, you know, I spend far less time on the web and far more time on my net apps on my iPhone or iPad than I did in the past. Does all of this start to, you know, start to dice that up? Steve, what do you think?
Well, you know, as I was listening to Tim speak, I was thinking, okay, wait a second. If I have a Google TV, you know, it's on my TV, so I can get all the stations on cable that I want. So really, I might not care if the stations are on Google TV, because I'm going to Google TV to get all the web stuff.
Right.
Right?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think the idea is down the road that people just start going to Google TV. I think that's the fear that they have, is that they'll stop going to the TV itself and just pulling everything down through Google TV.
Oh, you mean, and then stop paying for cable TV and just use the Google TV for everything off the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that seems to be the constant fear. I mean, I look at it. I mean, the only reason that, I think I've talked about this before, there's only two things that keep, you know, cable in our house is my wife likes to watch Oprah and I like to watch Good Eats, and you can't get either of those on you know either of those on TV.
That's distinction, yeah.
You know, so but you know but these little bits of content are important. It's you know, for us it's Oprah and Alton Brown. For other people it's, you know, Steeler football, or it's college football, or you know, it's the certain kind of news they want to watch. And as that content starts to all, you know, find its way onto live, you know, onto the internet,
Right.
The question is whether people will, you know, it's not that one thing will turn everybody off, but the idea is you'll keep on seeing this erosion of people paying for premium content. I know that I just got the PBS. Have you guys downloaded the PBS app for the iPad?
No, I haven't.
Stunning. That's all I have to say. I was just like, it was, I'm probably the show I watched the most between the time I was probably 3 and 6 or 7 years old was PBS. So what my parents would let me watch. And I just watched it, you know, day in, day out. And so it's always been this thing that I just love watching PBS. And I've always wanted to be portable like that. And it just works so well. It's just this great app. And at first I thought when I downloaded it, all I was going to be able to watch is, I was just gonna be able to watch previews. But I watched the whole front line on vaccination this morning while I was getting everything else ready to go on my iPad, just kind of picking it up and setting it in the kitchen while I was making breakfast and then setting it down in the office while I'm organizing things. And I was just like, this is it. This is, you know, this is exactly the kind of stuff that I want. And I love the fact that I could pick, it's not all the shows that they have there. But here's the issue is that I would be happy to pay, you know, $10 a month to have, you know, all access to the archives of PBS and being able to watch any of the front lines that I want to watch or any of the Novas that I want to watch, and having a deeper, you know, library, you know, into single areas. And there's certain networks that can do that, whether it's maybe Discovery, HBO, Showtime, PBS. There's a handful of these that could get into some kind of pay-per-view, situation. But once a couple of us get enough of those, we start adding that up and go, well, I'm not going to pay for cable anymore. You know, that's the danger is that what if we do start to a la carte the different networks? Tim, do you think that that's a possibility?
Well, the cable networks are working hard to prevent it. You look at the Fox networks, they make about $3 billion a year from licensing fees to the MSOs. These cable networks are now pulling back the full episodes that they have available on websites. So if you go to foodnetwork.com right now, you'll notice that video is pretty much hidden on their site, whereas it used to be up front and center. And right now it's hard to find the video stuff on Food Network. Same thing for Discovery. Discovery's pulling back on their video content offerings online as well. They're just going to be putting up clips, whereas they used to have full episodes up as well. A lot of this has to do with the iPad and content being available on the iPad. There was a jump from Flash to HTML5, and some people took that leap. Other people said, you know what, we need to listen to the MSOs so that we don't hurt those licensing fees, because that's where we make our money. Now, what's going to be interesting to me is if you look at what Apple did in the music business, they took somebody else's problem and they solved it themselves and they kept the change. So is somebody else going to make Google TV work for them and create high quality programming that people want to watch on a Google TV and want to find on a Google TV? And then all of a sudden the cable networks are like, hey, wait a second, we're just like the record companies.
Well, is the danger, and this is what I think happened to the record companies in some ways, is the danger that the media industry will try to protect their past too long and give up their future, you know, along the way.
Absolutely. I mean, they've got to figure out how to move forward without cannibalizing their own. I mean, look at Netflix. Netflix was not a streaming company when it started, but it knew that was the future, and it got into it. And, you know, Blockbuster could have bypassed the DVD mailing business and gotten into the streaming business, but they didn't.
Right, because their feet were too driven into one area.
You know, absolutely.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of Flash, one of the things that came up, there's two things, actually, that came up with Flash. First of all, Apple has announced that they are no longer automatically installing Flash. So your Mac is not going to come with Flash installed. Apple says, of course, that this is not against Flash. We're just simply making sure that everybody has the most quote-unquote up-to-date version of Flash, and we want to make sure that they're not getting old versions on whatever shipped with our computer, because, of course, Apple is, I think the implicit thing here is that Flash is, you want to make sure you have your security updates and your stability updates and make sure that everything's new. But this is obviously an ongoing battle that's going on between Apple and Flash, and taking it off of an entire platform, even though it's a minority platform, has got to have a big effect on Adobe. Steve, how do you think this affects where Adobe's going with Flash?
Well, I think that when you go to, let's say you have your iPad and you go to watch, it's not iPad, it's the new Macs, those new Mac Airs. Mm-hmm. So when you're on a Mac and you go to watch something in Flash, it's going to say install plugin, right? So
yep. You won't. I mean, a long time ago, we really had this whole thing where we were. I think that's the whole Apple process here. Is that a long time ago we were used to installing plugins. We'd get it. Oh, I got to install this plugin. You click it, and then you had it. Nowadays, I have to admit that if I see a plugin, even a Flash one, I'm like, oh, it's another thing I got to deal with, and I tend to just kind of move on. I mean, is that the real danger for Adobe, is that you lose an entire platform?
Well, you know what? There's something that I just heard. I'd love to find the article. It said that it was somewhere in the 20% range of iPad owners haven't downloaded any apps.
It turned out to be about 10%.
Oh, it was 10.
It started off as 31 and 3, and then they did some revision, and people were like, "Yeah, you're full of it." And then they went back and they played with the numbers and they said, "Okay, it's really 1 in 10."
It's really 1 in 10. So there are people who are, you're right, they're going to come up to that and they're going to go, oh, I have no idea, and just move along.
Lon, do you think that this is a big issue, or is this a nothing? Apple's doesn't have enough impact on their market.
I think if it went across to all of their other computers, it might be a bigger issue than it is. It's clearly aimed at content creators to say, look, anyone who buys this flashy new Mac is not going to be able to look at your stuff if it's in Flash. And it's certainly another shot from Steve to another company that he does not like very much.
The other thing is that the issue is that, of course, Apple argues that Flash is less stable. And I have to admit, if there's going to be a memory leak or some kind of craziness that goes on my computer, most of the time I notice that there's Flash running in Firefox. That seems to be, for me, the combination that causes trouble on my platform. But the interesting thing is that again, the cross section of Mac users, especially, you get really clear of this. I spend a lot of time in airports, and you realize that almost everybody around you has a Mac or an iPad or an iPhone. And there is the affluent, the top 20%, 30% of the population in the United States while Apple may only have 10 or 15% of the total market, they are having a growing part, a very quickly growing percentage that's much higher. Some people are saying as much as 50 or 60% of the student or the upper middle class market. And of course, advertisers want to have access to that market. If Apple starts to restrain access, it makes it very complicated for people to use technologies that don't make it to that market. Tim, do you think this is really an issue?
Oh, hold on. I was just installing a Flash HTML5 plugin so that I could watch HTML5 video in my Flash player. Hold on. I got spinning beach ball. I'm going to be here all day. What was it? What were you saying?
Yeah, exactly. Well, now, one of the things that was announced, though, that is an interesting adjustment to this is Adobe. This is Adobe, the Adobe Max conference, which is going on right now. They have announced that they have a new ad format. Ads can display in the Flash format or can be converted to HTML5. So for devices that don't support Flash. So the idea is you'll be able to develop all of this stuff, in the stuff that designers are the most comfortable with. I mean, I was talking to I think the one thing we have to look at with Flash is the top ad designers, the top display designers generally are, because of the history, Flash, designers. I mean, they're the ones that have been doing this for the longest. I was talking to a company talking to a Pixelcor member actually in London, and he was talking about the fact that they, you know, there's this thing called Casper CG, which is a it is a broadcast graphics open source project done by the Swedish government, and one thing that's interesting about it is instead of sitting on top of After Effects or Motion or other things, it's sitting on top of Flash, and one of the reasons that they chose that was because they found that all the good display designers that could do great graphics for TV were all, you know, if they were able to develop in Flash, you got really a plethora of artists that were able to do very high-end work. So now people are going to be able to take advantage of that and be able to export it to HTML5. Tim, do you think that HTML5 is the... Do you think that really the future for Adobe is to just develop their tools to develop HTML5 content and not worry about how it comes out the other end?
Well, I mean, they're trying to hold on to their legacy of Flash, but it does look like HTML5 video is the future. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of these people are forgetting is that when people are watching HTML5 video on their iPad, it goes full screen. They're watching their videos full screen. So if you have a companion banner ad on your website, that's kind of lost. You know, you're not getting a page view. So you need to know HTML5 video. You need to know HTML5 streaming. You need to understand how to serve in-stream advertising. And I think that's the future, and that's kind of the place that I'm playing right now.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if you – did you guys see any of this with the 2D barcode technology for smartphones? So trying to think, see where I got this, actually. This is in the New York Times. They're testing – of course, a lot of you have seen probably these barcodes. They look like those funky, pixelated, images. Instead of, it's the 2D barcode technology. And essentially now people are starting to put this promotion is being done by Lamar Advertising Company that is putting these on the billboards. Like, you know, so on the display ads, there's this thing. And if you take a picture of them, or if you can use your smartphone to scan them and get more information. And I thought this was a really interesting integration of print media, possibly with advertising. Do you guys think that there's a future in being able to add things that allow your smartphone to instantly give you information? Is this something that you would use, Lon?
It's the return of the QCAT, I think, the Radio Shack thing. I don't know. I don't know if people generally don't go out and seek additional information from an advertiser, at least in my experience, that to go through the process of loading up an app to go scan a billboard and then get spam emailed to you just doesn't seem all that appealing to me. But I think there are probably more creative ways to do it, you know, especially in maybe syncing up content with a live television event or something that gives me some additional value for the content that either I'm paying to consume or I'm already consuming might be a little bit more attractive. But this barcode thing keeps getting tried every time there's a new opportunity to try it out with a different piece of hardware. But I think the large and long and short of it is the only barcodes I'm going to see on my phone are probably airline check-in codes.
Excited about. I can't wait to not have to deal with a paper ticket. In fact, one of the things that's interesting, though, is I find that the place that I take the most pictures of ads that I want to remember is in flight. I open up, I forget to buy an Economist or something before we take off, and now I'm stuck for the first 10 minutes without being able to open up my iPad, which is very traumatic for me. And I find that I go through the ads, and there's ads in the in-flight magazines, not the Air Mall or whatever, but the Air Mall too, but the other ones that are only in those magazines. They're only, they're just for travelers, and this is the niche market that they've chosen to advertise in. And I, as someone who travels a lot, goes, oh, that bag looks really great, or that little hook, oh, I need that. And I'm always afraid of forgetting it, and I find that I take a lot of pictures, and that's the one place that I see, like, print ads, actually, that I could somehow collect that data without having to take a picture of the ad and then figure out where the URL is. Steve, do you think you would use this ad program to get more information?
I think in the example that you just said, like that, for sometimes it's hard to type in like the whole URL of whatever it is they want you to type in. So if you can just point your phone at it, and so what it really does is translate that thing into a URL that you go to for more information. So I think it sounds great for that and getting the URL into your phone. So you don't have to type the whole thing in.
Well, it also gives the advertiser will know not only where they saw that, but they could, you know, with that 2D code, you can get, they can know exactly which magazine, you know, like which magazine, what page, or where in the airport they saw that advertisement, you know, because that, you know, all of that can be embedded into what's being uploaded. It doesn't need to have the person's personal information, but just all the access, you know, they'll know that this many people saw that billboard and hit that code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interim technology. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like DVDs. It's going to be around for a little while, but not forever. In Japan, the technology is already there to take a picture of something, and it will go find that thing for you. So I think we're going to see that. I think we're also going to see, you know, maybe a billboard. You take a picture of that billboard, and it schedules your TiVo to record that show. Yeah. I think, you know, that's the type of integration that we're going to see. And those QR codes are so ugly. I mean, they're just disgusting from a design standpoint. So they're going to go away.
Well, I know. Yeah, I definitely see more of that in Japan. I was just there a couple weeks ago, and there's definitely a lot that you can take a picture of, and also proximity, you know, where you can get close enough to something and get more information about it on your phone or on your, you know, which is, you know, going to Japan is always like going a decade into the future. You know, you just get to see all this crazy stuff that we won't see for quite some time. Speaking of Japan and our final story, Sony, I cried a little here. Sony is making their last cassette Walkman. I was surprised they actually were making them.
Me too.
but you know, I don't know how many of us had cassette Walkmans, but I think it's the end of an era. You know, as Sony has now, I guess they started making them in 1983, I think. I think this is according to Tech Dirt. And 1979, I'm sorry. I think I got my first one in 1982 or 83. And the sports Walkman for me was the one that I destroyed a couple of them, but they were my skiing Walkman, and but I think this is the end, and I, you know, I think that this is, you know, this is a lot of what I know. There was a lot of history of Steve Jobs being very obsessed with the Sony Walkman when it came out. He was so impressed with the craftsmanship that he took it all apart and looked at it and looked at how they put all that stuff together, and it made a big impact on him. Did you guys have? Did everyone here have a Sony Walkman at some point in time?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, I still have one. When I dress up in my Back to Future outfit, I wait to find somebody sleeping. I put the headphones on. I am Darth Vader.
And now, of course, we're seeing rumors that Apple, you know, the rumor now, of course, is that Apple may buy Sony, which would be quite a wow. Well, they, you know, they've got some money.
What would that do for Google TV?
It'd be the end of Google TV. Well, it'd be the end of it on Sony. I mean, Sony would provide. Sony doesn't just provide Apple with hardware production capabilities. It also provides Apple with a huge content library, so which could be interesting as well. You know, I used to work for Sony, so long, long, long time ago. So so there's a lot of music there in Sony Music that's part of that consortium, so it'd be very interesting to see how that goes. Anyway, Steve, where can people find you?
People can find me at stevegarfield.com, and my weekly live show is at stevegarfield.tv.
Great. Lon, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter, LonSeidman, and they can also check out West Hartford Local News at localonlinenews.tv. And on November 1st, I'm going to be down at Cape Canaveral live streaming to Dane Golden's Hey.com coverage of the Space Shuttle Discovery launch. I'm going to be part of the NASA tweet-up event that's going on down there. I'm really excited about that. So
I'm so jealous.
It's really cool. It's going to be really, really cool. I'll send pictures.
Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com, where I've recently posted an interview with Kevin Pollak from the Kevin Pollak Chat Show.
Great. Fantastic. Well, this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jaminkar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.